I think this will stand as my favourite text of the morning, regardless of how well you go from here. In shock, just did ladder predictor. So you sort of had me at hello. You've done the ladder predictor after round 9. Salute. Have Saints and Blues in top 4, plus Gold Coast 6th. Cats and Dogs miss out. And then there's quite the emoji in the aftermath. Well done doing the ladder predictor after round 9. The search for meaning in all of it. David King, welcome to the Means Test.
Morning, G. If I gave you the ladder predictor of the first 9 rounds, I reckon you'd get it wrong.
Yes.
If you had to sit down and start again.
Yeah, did they really beat them?
No, that didn't happen, did it?
What's your King's Gambit? What's your opening declaration?
I think the more we watch them, the more we just reaffirm that these sides are good in areas that they're good at. We've talked about them all year. If you want to use an analogy, if it was a one-day cricket game, we now move into the phase where it's, say, the 20-over mark. You bring on your spinners.
Oh, the milking overs.
The milking overs. And from the 20-over mark to the 40-over mark, you just rotate the strike, Jared, build the score, and then unleash late. So the next sort of 6 to 8 weeks becomes a bit of a holding pattern, I think. We know what we know about these teams now. So you look at that Geelong and St Kilda game as an example, and we'll go deeper into it later on. If you can do this against Geelong, you can get them. But it's hard to do against them. And if the Saints, conversely, Geelong know how to get the Saints. If you can do this against the Saints, you get them. So everyone's got a flaw. Everyone's got a weakness, an avenue. Some are greater than others. But we know them now. I think after 8-9 weeks, you get a really good handle, a really good body of work to sit back and assess. And I think that's where we are right now.
Right. The big issue is clearly Essendon turning in that performance on Saturday night, and the level of discontent in their community, the despondency that set in watching that game. That was a terrible performance, just as a neutral observer. And to come a week after the spiritually uplifting moment, the question for them was, what would it amount to? And it amounted to nothing.
They've become a hard watch, haven't they? Look, I don't know what's happened at Essendon, because it was only about 3 years ago I thought they had the list to win a flag, 3-4 years ago. And then their list has potentially got better since then. I know they lost Danaher, which was a big, big loss for the structure of that side. And if he's there, does he win your games? He probably does. But the talent they had come in over the last 2 to 3 years, high-end draft selections, young kids that are going to be stars, and still there performing, you know, Perkins and Hobbs and Reed, these guys. I don't know what's happened. I really don't. And all you can do is, I think they live a lie a little bit, the Bombers. I don't know if their leaders are absolutely honest with the group. It's a warm and fuzzy environment out there internally, and sometimes warm and fuzzy doesn't really thrash out the problems, you know. Everyone sort of talks about, you know, it's a real positive, and it's not about the smiling and laughing at training. It's not. I'm with Tyson Heppel on that. You've got to be able to get over the loss. You can't carry a loss for 5 days. That's unhealthy. But you've got to be able to walk up to someone and say, hey, listen, if you keep doing that, you're out of the team. Simple, hard, cold facts. They had an opportunity to correct and maintain selection integrity a few weeks ago when they dropped Dylan Shield, made a big song and dance about it, and brought him back into the team, made him sub. We don't like what you're doing. We've got standards here. Oh, hang on, but you're in our best 23. So if someone gets injured, you come on and we like your standards then. You either make the statement or you don't. They watered it down. And I think that's now, it's got a bit of a lag on the group. Let's start with the captain. Is he in their best halfback group? Like, does he have a role in the team at the moment? Like, and Jack Zeeble's in the same conversation. And it's difficult when your captain is not in great form and doesn't really, I mean, where does he sit in terms of the halfback flankers in the competition right now? Would you have him in the top 10 halfback flankers? Probably not. Definitely not. Would you have him in the top 20? Probably not. So he's not damaging by foot. He can't stop a man. He's not a great. He's getting his positioning wrong regularly, and being made look second rate because the ball movement's coming so fast and the midfield not putting any pressure on. Everything is working against him. So I think, well, gee, that's an awkward situation. So how honest are they internally? What does Ben Rutten say to Dyson Heppel? mate, we, you know, do they move him to the wing? Do they reset him in the midfield? Do they say, gee, we don't know where you are, mate? And I know it's his 200th game on the weekend. We were never going to do this prior to his 200th, but let's call a spade a spade. What is his best position for Essendon right now? No one's got the answer. Mm. But they're the sort of conversations you need to have. And I said the same thing about Jack Zee. Well, Jack Zee will be getting a game at any of the top eight teams, any of them. And where would he be playing? Because he went forward 5 weeks ago against the Swans and kicked 5 goals. But they said he could no longer be a forward at the start of the year, or the start of last year when he went back. So now they return back to something they know is probably not going to work long term, and now you're stuck. What do you do now? Move him down back again? Hardly influencing games. So when your captain is not influencing, you're in a world of pain. That's the truth.
Yep.
But are they honest enough at Essendon to sit down and talk facts and sense and have those hard conversations? I don't think they are.
Do they lack any air of ruthlessness? Do you buy into that part of the conversation?
You know what? I reckon what Matthew Lloyd said on Sunday on the Footy Show was as good as I've heard for a long time. And he said it with passion, and he was challenged on what he said. And I sat back and thought, that is 100% right. They needed a statement. They needed someone to make a statement. They've needed someone to make a statement for 9 weeks. The coach tried to do it but watered it down. No one did it in game when they were challenged physically and Merritt was bowled over. Dylan Sheil accepted what Luke Parker said to him and did to him and belittled him really in the football world. Luke Parker knew what he was doing. Do you reckon Luke Parker thinks for a moment that's not going to be shown on national television for all of us to talk about after, what, 10 years in the game? He knows where the cameras are. That was his little statement. And they accepted it. They wore it. No one made a statement. So I agree with Matthew Lloyd.
Yeah, I was the same, I must confess. I'm probably not drawn to that normally. But when he said it, I thought, yeah, actually, that's really hard to disagree with.
Put yourself in that position,
and
Jerry.
coming from a true Essendon place. So I thought that he was able to morph himself into that.
Yeah.
He's lived probably these moments. Yeah, I was with you on that.
So you be Dyson. I keep saying Dyson. You be Dylan Sheil for a moment, and have that player basically putting you on the radar for the world to look at and to critique. So when that comes, everyone says, "Oh, did he duck his head? Where did he duck? Let's go back and have a look at the vision. Let's find that moment where he ducked his head. He must have ducked his head." And we all did it. We all went looking, and you couldn't find it anywhere. So it was a great stooge by Luke Parker, and it got the response. It definitely did. But Dylan Sheil would have felt one out. Not one person come to help. No one flew the flag for their own. I found that really weird.
Yep.
Wouldn't happen to the good teams. No way. You go after Petrarca, you got Gawn and Oliver and Viney coming at you. You go after Cam Rayner, you have the whole world come at you from the Brisbane Lions point of view. Wouldn't happen.
So what do you think the path for them is? So they're 2-7. They look utterly cast. They've got this really strange set of feature games coming up, which is almost a disaster for them. Like, to be thrust into centre stage soon enough on Friday nights is, if they're still failing in such a way, like they're not hiding anyway, but when you get thrust into that environment, that the scrutiny is going to be utterly ferocious from here on, like it is now, and rightfully so. I agree with that, rightfully so. But it's only likely to get more intense.
So do you think that's a bad thing?
It's a bad thing if they can't. So they look lost. They got the circuit breaker response on which to build, and then they went back to being, that's their worst performance of the year. And they've had some signature horror performances. That was the worst of them coming right off that. So that worries me enormously. So you talk about living a lie. Okay, so we put everything into the game before and they get the alibi, they get the right team at the right time. Hawthorn aren't running the game out. all over the top. You say all the right things. You look like you've made, and then it's gone. Like there wasn't a remnant of the previous Saturday night to the next Saturday night. That's troubling.
Yeah. And last week, so let's not confuse this. Last week we were proud of the way that Ben Rutten coached and said, no, we're not going to just stack the back line. We're going to stick true to our offense and we're going to attack and we're going to run and gun and all those things that we wanted to see from them this year, they reverted back to, or they made change. So now where do you go to is the tough point. I think you've got to start, and again, they've lost selection integrity. That's gone. So let's not talk about dropping players and doing that sort of stuff, because that they've lost that lever, okay? They've lost the shock factor to the group with that. So I think you've got to prioritise your positions. So don't reward guys that are not prepared to two-way run and put pressure on with midfield minutes and go past them. So if McGrath's not prepared to run a gun, will you play halfback flank? You're not ready to be a midfielder for us. If Darcy Parrish doesn't want to tackle and wants to run around and get 40, not for us. You go to a half forward flank and get them out of those roles before the younger players see that as the way forward. Hobbs is watching everything they're doing. Perkins is watching everything these guys are doing. So you have to stop this bleeding into the next group. Otherwise, you've got another decade of this. And the ultimate circuit breaker is to change the message, to change the man at the top. And we're not into that. We're not cheering for that. You said last week he's got to get the job right rather than fight for his job. I agree with that. So I think the only way to do that is to prioritise positions on the ground and reward those that are prepared to play the right way for this coach.
They are the big issue, the Bombers. There's a lot of thoughts around them. I'll share those as we work our way through the means tests. We've got the pressure index, the best bits, the worst bits, the debate, preliminary final integrity. We'll zero in on St Kilda and Geelong because it was such an interesting case study. The Suns are the curiosity. What becomes of the Suns? Is this the rise? We'll ponder that with David King on this means test.
Doherty in some space, can run to the front edge of the square, pulls the trigger, Doherty! Good night, Giants. All the best, Leon. You deserve better than this today. They get to Doherty, and why wouldn't you? The most inspiring story of the year is that man, and he has pulled out a one wood we didn't know he had and plonked it right down the middle of the fairway from, I'm going to say, 60 metres.
So I think that was the best moment of the weekend for me. The goal, and we know what it represents, but Charlie Curnow, not just that he was the first to Doherty, but he ended up falling over. So exuberant were they in the celebration. Charlie Curnow's on the ground in the aftermath. Fantastic.
It's just a great environment at the moment, isn't it? When you're winning games of football and everything's working, the little emotional hooks that really get us all going to see him a couple of weeks back with Ben Cunnington was a real tug at the heart. And then to see him playing good football.
Yeah.
Like he's playing some good football. Like that's a leader that we should be talking about. Follow me. You know, I'm not the best player here out on the ground, but I'm going to give you everything I've got. He did flush that. He did flush
yeah,
that.
Did he
ball
what?
Too.
And I think the worst bit, so if you haven't seen Liam Ryan's hit on Jake Bowie, this is the exact action. So Bowie, head over the ball. Liam Ryan, no regard for Bowie whatsoever, bumps him in the head. Has to be multiple weeks. That's an awful action from Ryan.
Pass the footy by a metre. These guys know exactly where the football's going to be when they arrive. He steps past the football to hit this guy in the head. It's as simple as that. And we'll talk about this again next week, Jared, because you know what? We're not changing behaviour.
Totally avoidable. There have been some that have been borderline in recent times. This is cut and dry, multiple weeks required for Liam Ryan. We're in the means test with David King. Our Monday means test for round 9. David King is in place. We've got a lot to work through. Let's do preliminary final integrity. We're going to promote it up the order because the St Kilda Geelong game was so good and is so rich with the source material here.
This was a cracking game. And everyone will want to talk Geelong down because they lost and St Kilda up because they won. Let's just share it. Let's just split it. Let's just say that forget the winning and the losing for a sec and just look at the game. St Kilda were able to break down Geelong in a short space of time. Call it 30% of the game. And in that 30%, they smashed them. They got it all on the scoreboard. Well done. They bypassed the intercept players. They played with dare. They carried the ball a bit deeper. They made speed an issue for the Cats. And that's as soon as you can do that, leg speed, I'm talking about, not ball speed, leg speed, then you get them. Okay? Geelong know all this. They know all that. They know they haven't recruited speed and they haven't got speed. But if they are able to play their set solid defence and get enough ball clearance and enough tough footy and keep the game in traffic, then they get you. And they probably had the Saints for 70% of that game. But they end up getting rolled. It's a 10-point margin. So I think both coaches walk away and go, okay, that's all right. Chris Scott's not distraught about what happened on the weekend. But I think for the Saints, it has a bigger purpose because now I think Brett Ratten can walk in and say, hey, we can beat anyone. I think the Cats, they are the gatekeepers to the top four.
Yeah, so for me, they're the bellwether seat. If you're moving in, you got to be winning the Geelong battle. So you think they're the gatekeeper.
Yeah, so if you can get past Geelong, you can make your way in the top four. I think they'll finish fourth, fifth or sixth Geelong. I think they're a seriously good team that have got strike power. And I personally don't think Chris Scott's too concerned where they finish in the eight as long as they're in the eight and healthy. That's all they're worried about this year. They've done the other path of trying to finish top and, you know, try and run the table and see where it takes you, and it hasn't worked. So I think that they've loaded up to be more offensively geared, more daring. There's a different level of risk now with the Cats. And there's some teething issues along the way. So I think this next, even though we're saying it's they've brought the spinners on, it's over 25, Jared, or over 20's just started, that this next 6 to 8 weeks is still important for them to grow and learn a bit more about each other. They've got a back line that's mixed up. It's a different sort of back line at the moment. And again, they're doing some different things. So I thought it was a really good game. The thing that really hit me with the Saints is their ability to adapt and play a more aggressive game as a one-off type performance against the Cats to carry and run the ball. And it was different players. I haven't seen Jones play with that sort of composure. You know, he's a bit of a blaster. It's all quick. Saw Gresham just toy with them at times. And then you see the team first stuff. And we talked a couple of weeks ago about Brad Hill running back to block Max King's man and allowing him a clean jump at the ball. Well, I saw Jones do it as well. And I thought, wow, they're all invested in someone else. I think that's a great sign that you're on the same page as a group, and that if Max gets a goal, we get a goal. It's not I need to get a goal. So I think there's a lot to like about what the Saints did and what the Saints are doing, but I'm certainly not pouring cold water on the Cats.
I thought the most significant player, so I went back and watched the 20 minutes again to try to understand what had happened. I thought the most significant player was Seb Ross in that period of time. So there was great stuff happening in the ruck, and they were sound down back and good up front. Just Ross's explosiveness when he got the footy exposed a few, and on numerous occasions in that sweep set them up.
Yeah, a lot of their scoring come from stoppage. So he's their ability to hit to advantage and then exit pure was a feature, no doubt. But from that moment onwards, that you've got to make sure you don't turn the ball over. So it'll read as scores from stoppage, right? It'll read as damage from stoppage. And this is where numbers can lie to you. Because normally that next possession is under pressure, and then it turns over, Cats win it back, and then Cats score from turnover. Despite the fact you've won the clearance, they score from turnover. Well, they didn't do that. So when you read it, it reads Cats 60 points to 30 from stoppage. You go, oh, they must have just hit, you know, been pure and just got it on the scoreboard, perfect plays. But when you look deeper into it and you go into Geelong only scoring 37 points from turnover, you say, well, they didn't give it back to them. And that's the key with Geelong. We've seen many different approaches. We've seen the chip mark, build the ball slowly, which was a little bit of a little bit boring, a little bit tedious, and it gave them more time to set up. So you see Stewart behind the ball, you see Duncan behind the ball, you see Blitzarves rolling back. You see the ruckman down the line. They didn't do that. So I think there's a level of maturity about this win that says we're just not giving the ball back. So don't just fall into the stoppage numbers. It's about denying the Cats what they want. It was a great win.
It is almost unthinkable that tragedy could strike in cricket circles again and leave such a pall of sadness after the recent sudden deaths of first Dean Jones and then Shane Warne and now Andrew Symonds, who was, he was such a beautiful figure in the Warne memorials and the like, and linked together by that Boxing Day test match where Warne took his 700th wicket and the next day Symonds made the test century. That was his defining moment in the cream flannels. His signature moments are so easily recounted and recalled, all dreadlocks and lip cream. The big North Queenslander who truly did love to hunt and fish, described as the heart and soul teammate. And he was an explosive cricketer that challenged conventions. World Cup century in 2003, Boxing Day test century at the MCG, fielding exploits that perhaps were only rivaled by Jonty Rhodes, and the best hip and shoulder that we ever saw on a cricket field when he brought down the streaker that night at the Gabba. Yesterday, again, in just these terrible circumstances, Adam Gilchrist, Ian Healy, Damien Fleming called together to recall, to share their sadness and to share their memories of the late Andrew Symonds.
Simply stunned. Can't believe we're in this space again. The cricketing world and, well, just anyone that had anything to do with Simo knows exactly what he was like. And he was one of the good guys. Really, really heart and soul type of guy that just made you feel happy. He lightened up a room wherever he was. And he was just... going to be so sorely missed, mate.
Yeah, he was just a great bloke to have around the net and around the dressing room and then on the field even, you know, to this very day on tour. And he's going to be extremely missed.
Just devastating news, firstly, obviously, for his family and young kids. But, you know, for the cricketing fraternity, as you'll hear from the tributes, he was just so popular. You know, I just loved him.
That was the tribute on SEN yesterday, which unfortunately we've had to convene just too often in recent times. If Shane Warne and Dean Jones had an element that was intrinsically Victorian, this is absolutely a Queensland story. The wisdom and experience of Robert Craddock this Monday morning. Crash, welcome.
Oh, thanks, Jared. Yeah, you could hear it in their voices. They were wobbling, weren't they? And do you know what? I'll say it first because otherwise I don't want to forget it, but I just want to also pay tribute to Adam Gilchrist. Over the last year, with all these stunning fatalities, he has risen every time. In those opening few hours when he was wobbling himself, and he's a very emotional man, he has put his hand up to be front and centre and to pay tribute to people when many of his teammates just couldn't do it. And he knew it would expose his vulnerabilities, but he did it anyway. And I just think he's emerged as just a first-class fellow. Not that we needed confirmation, but he just is.
So it's a terrible stretch, is those taken too soon. So that's Dean Jones and Shane Warne and now Andrew Symonds and Rod Marsh, which went right to the heart of so many growing up. His was slightly different, but it's just unthinkable, Crash, this litany of tragedy.
And they were the very fabric of what makes our game great. There are four totally original characters, Cavaliers, you know, baggy green, gum leaf green characters who were just so much at the essence about what Australian cricket prides itself on. But, you know, Andrew Symonds had a soft side, and you mentioned it with his tribute to Shane Warne. I know when they were getting ready to go into that tribute, he was the one who was feeling doughiest. And Steve Crawley actually had to say to him, Andrew, I know you can do this. Warney would want you to muscle up, be strong, you know. And he did, and he later thanked Steve for saying it. So, you know, he was... there were so many shades to Andrew. The Cavalier, deep down, he lacked confidence, though. He really did. That's why he was a slow starter at sort of interstate level and test level. Then there was the iconic fieldsman. I've got him number one, Jared, as the top fieldsman. I just felt his power. He was more powerful than Jonty Rhodes. He had better hands than Herschel Gibbs. And he was... It said a lot about him as a team man because, you know what? Fielding in those days wasn't... There was no statistics. It was all about just putting in for the team. Were you generous enough? And he always was.
A quintessential Queenslander?
Oh, yeah. Well, see, money meant nothing to him, mate. All he wanted was his tinny, which he had. He had his fishing rod, his crab pots in Townsville. He'd write the tide times on the on his window in the car, and he'd just look it up, and he had his dogs, and they were there for him at the very end. And Matthew Hayden said to me last night from India, he said the very fact that his pet Kelpies were milling around Andrew after he had passed and were very concerned and were even nipping at the heels of rescue workers, Haydos said, mate, you know what I am? I'm one of them. I'm one of his pet dogs in spirit. Like, you know, you feel that loyalty to him, that unyielding sort of faith in an old mate. So, you know, and Jared, we have to be honest here. Most of the journos over the time had big blues with Andrew. He was volatile and all that. But we were always acutely aware that those guys in the dressing room, Gilchrist, Ponting, Hussey, Hayden, would always have his back and say to you, mate, I know he has his funny spots, Roy, but he's a good guy, you know? And they didn't say that about everyone. Yeah. So that convinced us that he was a man of fibre. But he was better with adults than he was with children. With children than he was with adults. He loved kids because he felt he could look into their eyes and trust them, whereas adults had to earn his trust and some never did. And if you were his captain and he didn't trust you, he didn't do his best. Like, he just couldn't, the flame wouldn't flicker up.
Nathan texts through, Crash, was with my dad the day Roy and Haydos saved an early Ashes batting collapse at the G. Was pure hitting at its best. We'll never forget the embrace when he brought up the 100 with that glorious six down the ground. Goosebumps moment and one that will live with me the rest of my days. So he has those signature moments,
oh, yeah,
doesn't he? That's right there. And the hip and shoulder of the streaker at the Gabba, which goes so much to his character as well as his sporting prowess.
Oh, yeah. Well, the MCG moment, Hayden said to me last night from Mumbai, he said, that's my greatest moment in cricket. He said, because Roy and I had been to weddings, funerals, with kids born, everything. And after 20 years, he came in and he said he couldn't hit the ball off the square. And Kevin Peterson was saying to him, come on, mate, I know it's hard for you. You've been chosen as a specialist fieldsman, but see if you can put a bat on a ball. And he said, Simon's just snapped and thought, right, okay, pal, you and your tight singlets that you wear out at night, no wonder if you don't have to pay any excess luggage. So it was on, and Hayden said it was the best thing that happened to him. But Hayden said, when I felt that embrace, and he said the helmet cut into my forehead, and it was painful, he said, I just walked back. And he said, I knew it at the time. I walked back to the bowling crease, to the non-strikers end, and I thought, nothing will ever top that for me. After all we've been through, we said we've been shipwrecked when our boat sunk off Moreton Island. You know, we've seen divorces, marriages and everything. So, you know, this is the great fibre of a great team, and he had that in him. And may I say, Jared, one last thing. Andrew Symons averaged 40 as a test batsman, and he averaged one wicket per test. Now, that is a very underrated player. Ask England if they wouldn't mind someone like that in their middle order right now.
Yeah, well, I thought that was the line out of Gideon's piece this morning. His record is disarmingly excellent. Almost 7,000 international runs, averaging 40 from 26 tests and 198 one-day internationals at a time when Australian places were never more contested.
Yep. But, you know, he looked like a natural, but he sort of wasn't in a way.
Yeah.
Hayden said to him one day, he said, Simo, for you to be a natural, you've got to face 6,000 balls in the off season and then go out and throw away the sheet music. And then it all looks so natural. But you've got to hardwire that natural streak in you. That's a message, a story that any young sportsman could learn from. Learn your stuff and then throw away the sheet music when it matters. But Hayden would give him the raw truth. I mean, I remember when Symons went fishing and caught a barramundi during a team meeting in Darwin, and you know, they were apoplectic with disappointment about him doing it. And Hayden said he did smile when Symons sent him a photo of this giant barramundi he caught with the message, what's all the fuss about?
Right.
But he said, I laughed for a while and then I said to him, Roy, you've used up all your slack, mate. You either conform to this team and what it's trying to do. I know you're an old-fashioned cricketer. I know you don't like to be shackled, but you've got to conform. If you go the other way and retire, Hayden said, I'll support you to the day you die and say what a player you were, but, mate, there's nothing in between. You've got a decision to make. It's either A or B. And Jared, that's what mates are for, to have conversations like that.
Yes, yes. There's a lot pouring through, Crash, which I'll share. And you can call if you would like to, 1300 736 736. My memory of Andrew Symons was his innings in that opening game of the World Cup in 2003. Mm. I think he was only in the side because Ricky Ponting wanted him in when the selectors weren't sure. So that absolutely is one of them. And Jason in Windsor's tech through loved Andrew Symons commentating. He called out a player for a bad short or bowling or fielding in brutal honesty. Plus, he brought in his point system, his point scoring system to judge a player's game. Isha, Kath and Mark Waugh were at first confused. Then they got on board and always bring up Roy's system during a game.
Yeah, good stuff, exactly. I mean, when he was signed by Fox Sports, Adam Gilchrist went to Steve Crawley, the boss, and said, "This guy will surprise you. I know we're having a global hunt, we're getting all the big names. Go a step down. This guy's good." He said he's all his own man, and he was so intuitive and interesting. And when I spoke to his wife, Laura, yesterday, she said, "Do you know one thing about Andrew? She was always so self-conscious about his intellect. Like, he'd say things like, 'Oh, my kids are idiot-proof, even for me,' you know." Yeah. And she said, he said, "I never went to university. My marks at school were poor. But you know what? He was smart in a David Warner sort of way, just with instinct. His commentary was terrific. I really enjoyed it. You know, he was insightful and interesting, far better than he gave himself credit for, I have to say. Very good indeed."